Kim, thanks so much. It's Bill F. and Andrea Darlis filling in for the vacationing Wendy Snyder. Wendy will be back tomorrow. This is the time where we welcome our favorite Tribune columnist, certainly the most feisty of all, Eric Zorn. Hello, Eric. How are you? Hold on. Andrea. Wait, let me turn. There you go.
Oh, okay. I'll say that again. Better. Nice to see you, Bill. Nice to see you, Andrea. you know, I've been on Morning Joe on MSNBC.
Yeah.
They always introduce Mike Barnicle as the legendary columnist. And I'm thinking maybe I chose the wrong adjective.
No, no, no. I think feisty is more respectful.
Respectable. People would fear you more.
Yeah, legendary, too.
There you go.
Yeah. See,
but that goes without saying.
That validates
me. It'd be embarrassing to even say that.
No, like obvious.
You know how high maintenance I am. So.
Right. Extremely high maintenance. Yesterday, there were two different shows that I watched that were meant as entertainment shows, but because of what happened in Orlando, Florida, they had to make mention of it. So both at the Tony Awards and then later on John Oliver's show on HBO, they each took a moment or so to recognize what happened and to explain that they're operating under difficult circumstances, especially John Oliver, who said, look, we're just doing a dumb comedy show. We wrote a bunch of silly jokes and we're going to do them. But believe me when I tell you, we're respectful of what happened.
Yeah. Although John Oliver's show is, I think, very serious. I mean, it's funny, but he takes some serious topics and really goes after them.
Right.
And I assume he will probably be able to do that with this topic in a few weeks.
Yeah.
But I saw that cold opening of the Oliver show and it was, it was very
effective. And it did, you know, what it did was perfect was it says we're all aware of what happened and we're not trying to ignore it. But this is stuff that we spent all week writing and it's not as important as what happened. But just give us our due time on this, you know. So
it's almost like a moment of silence at something, a ball game or something before it actually starts.
I think everybody is just feeling this helplessness about things like this. And one of the things that we had a long conversation at the Tribune editorial board this morning, sort of saying, well, what can we do about this? What should we have done about this? What laws could have been in place that could have stopped this incident in Orlando? And it's very frustrating. I read a pretty interesting interview with a guy named Jeffrey Simon, who's written a book called Lone Wolf Terrorism, Understanding the Growing Threat.
We're currently working on having him on in the second half of today's show.
Oh, yeah. You are? Well, then I don't want to give away too much.
No, you can.
It was a really interesting interview. We talked a lot about how the internet enables and encourages people to do this, and it allows groups like ISIS to have these spectacular events and get all the credit for them without spending any money or using any of their organizational structure to attack the target and to claim this great victory for them. And at the end of the interview, they said, well, so, what can we do about this? He goes, well, this is a very difficult problem, and it's very hard to talk about because there really isn't much you can do when you have something, like the 9/11 attacks, where you've got this structure in place and they're funding it and they're training people and there's like chatter going on and people have to communicate. You've got some chance of picking up on the stuff that's in the air.
Right.
What's going on with these people. But when it's one crazy guy.
Right.
Who is licensed to carry a gun? I mean, he was a security guard.
I know.
The Orlando perpetrator. He was a security guard. He had undergone a deeper background check than a normal person would have undergone. And he is sitting in his home stewing and festering about having seen two men kissing. And he hatches a plot like this. I know we don't know everything yet about what had happened here, but it doesn't seem to anybody that this is the kind of thing that he was directed to do, ordered to do, or this was part of some sort of coordinated effort, that he just did this on his own. He invented it on his own. He answered the call. There was a call from the from al-Baghdadi, I believe it was maybe a month ago, saying that people who are supporters of ISIS during the month of Ramadan needed to make sure that they you perpetrated these kind of attacks. So
what was interesting, didn't you think, Bill, is that when Tom Mikaitis was on just a little while ago with us, and he almost looked at that, the fact that he was a lone wolf, as a bit of a silver lining. Not that you could look at anything positive that comes out of this.
Totally,
yeah, I
totally.
Yeah, I kind of did too, but Mikaitis thought that was, it's not part of this larger plot, that's going to be carried out at gay clubs all across the country or in certain locations, but that it was isolated. And I had kind of mixed emotions on that too.
But how do you combat that? I mean, we were talking in the meeting about, and I'm not sure, actually, I couldn't tell you what they concluded if I knew, but I know that they didn't come to a conclusion yet about what else we can say about what to do here. Because it seems like after every one of these events, like Newtown or Virginia Tech or Aurora, or Fort Hood, or all these places where you sort of look back and go, well, what could we have done to stop that one? And this is a particularly difficult one because, I mean, the guy was interviewed by the FBI. The one suggestion that I made.
More than once.
Yeah, one suggestion I made is that if you rise to that level of someone who has been interviewed by the FBI, who is on the radar screen, that maybe every time you buy weapons, that not that you're forbidden from buying weapons, not that you lose your rights, but that the alarm bells go off.
I completely agree. Like, yeah. There should be an asterisk.
I mean, this guy
there.
Went and he was. They questioned him twice. He had said some wacky things. They determined that he wasn't enough of a threat to put a tail on him or to be reading his email and so on. Because I mean, they can't. I mean, the idea that we would be able to do that for all the people who rise to that level is impossible. You can't. We don't have enough law enforcement. We don't have enough money to follow everybody around. But when someone like that goes and buys an assault weapon and the ammunition and so on. I think he tried to buy, I heard somewhere that he tried to buy a bought some body armor and things like that.
Right.
And when that happens, somebody ought to be alerted, and it ought to be sort of automatic. So the FBI says, hey, this guy we talked to 2 years ago, we didn't think he was that much of a problem, but now he's seems to be taking it another step. Let's check back in with him.
Think about when you buy a car or a home. You know, just take a car, because I bought a car about a year and a half ago. You know, it literally took a couple of days to go through the paperwork. They have to go through your financing and your check your credit score. I mean, there's a process that goes through it.
And that's for a car.
That's for a car. Same for a home. I mean, you have to get the loan and the credit and go through hoops, except if you go through David Hochberg, of course. But I mean... But you know what I mean, though, Eric? There has to be some sort of a process where maybe if you want to buy an AK-15 or an assault weapon, now that it's, you know, been used, the precedent's been set, it's already been used in at least three other mass shootings or massacres, if you will. There should be, you're right, a light that goes on that says, okay, you know what? This guy's been talked to twice. He's going to buy an AK-15. Let's do another, whatever the next level would be.
Let's swing by and talk to him again, see what's going on. Of course, then you get places like Boston. Every time someone buys a pressure cooker, you know, you got to check in with them. I mean, it's these kind of things. And I think the Sarnaev brothers, we've discovered, these are the guys in Boston who set off the bombs at the Boston Marathon. I don't think there was any real chatter about that, because it wasn't a coordinated plan. That was their idea, and they pulled it off on their own. So how do you stop that? But there, it seems to me that there are steps you can take at least to sort of make sure that more red flags are popping up. Now, the problem, it's politically difficult, because anytime you talk about registering people or putting people into databases when it comes to firearms, you're going to get a huge pushback.
Of course.
I'm not someone who's like a crazy gun grabber, and he says, I believe in that. Guns are good for people to have for self-protection if they want them. I'm fine with that. But I think that we do need to keep the kind of stuff that Andrea's talking about, where you keep track of who buys guns, where they are. And the idea of having a database of gun owners and keeping track of how they're moving around, that is anathema to the National Rifle Association. They think that is one step away from the government turning a switch and confiscating all of it.
But all that said, and we discussed this, Andrea said this at the top of the show, how many people would have to be on a list of saying, this guy or this girl is potentially dangerous. We work with him and he has said some awful things. I'm his ex-wife and he has threatened people. How many people would be on that list before they would take action? You know, if you were the guy being denied a firearm, you get a lawyer to argue the fact that the Constitution says until you've done something.
Yes, and that's true. And I think you couldn't actually say, no, you can't buy a weapon. I think that you would have to. All it would do is be raise a red flag. It would be like if this guy had been on, you know, the top of the radar screen for the FBI last week.
Yeah.
Maybe they would have seen something going on. They would have interviewed. They would have gone to talk to him. They would have said, this isn't sounding right. Maybe they could have said that. I mean, that's all I can come up with. I don't know what else, because you can't. He happened to use an assault weapon, or the military style assault weapon, but semi-automatic. But Virginia Tech, the guy who killed, what, he killed 35 people?
Yeah,
Tech,
he used
handguns. So people say, well, let's get rid of assault weapons. And that might do some good. It might deter some people. But, you know, maybe one thing that the editorial board has come out against before are these large magazines, these large ammunition clips.
Yeah.
Maybe make those smaller. That makes it a little more difficult. The person has to reload more often. That seems like a very small improvement, but maybe you have to take those incremental steps. But even those kind of things, you get a lot of pushback. So it is one of the most frustrating topics, because every time you start thinking, well, how could you stop that? And then you think, well, that's not the kind of country we live in.
Right.
Which is why some of the stuff that Donald Trump has been saying about this, you know, in the wake of it is so – is so kind of scary, because he, I feel like his pitch is going to be, I'm going to violate all of our principles except the Second Amendment in order to crack down on this.
I know.
And you know, that appeals to some people, because there is a sense like, what can we do? Well, maybe we can take away the rights of people who are Muslims or something like that.
It was curious to me that his attack yesterday on the president, Donald Trump's, was that he didn't want to use the word radical in describing what happened in Orlando or similar
incidents.
Well,
he didn't want to use the term Islamic. I think that was really, that was the...
Right. Well, yeah, but he used, by the way, he used the term, I know he said radical. I'm trying to remember if he said radical Islamists or Islam in his speech today.
Obama?
Yeah.
I didn't hear his speech today. I haven't heard it yet.
I think you're right. I think he said radicalized.
He did say radicalized.
Yeah, I think
that's the way he worded it.
He did say radicalized.
Right.
Yeah, he didn't say radical Islam.
But why is that such an issue, those particular words? Why does that upset Donald Trump so much?
It plays into people's sense that there is some sort of a political correctness that is preventing us from taking the steps that we need to take in the Middle East and domestically to deal with this problem.
Yeah.
And that if we don't identify Islam as the problem, then we're not going to be able to appropriately fight it. I don't think that's true. And I think, in fact, that when you gratuitously start trying to lump it all together and to blame Islam for this rather than these radical sects, this radical organization, you end up sort of inflaming the tensions in the Islamic world in general. You end up polarizing people there. And I think this isn't any kind of sensitivity on my part that makes me say it. I think it's just as a practical matter,
right.
You make things worse. You inflame these tensions. You increase the chances that somebody's going to decide they're going to go out and shoot people up when you keep lumping in and insulting their religion. And I mean, I just think it's not smart. And you know, they talk, obviously, at the highest levels of security about what the right words to use, you know, are and how to proceed. So they're not, it's not like Obama saying, well, I can't say that he was Islamic because, and you say maybe he did, but I can't say that because it's going to offend people. No, I think that's not it at all. I think that they are thinking strategically. So I reject this idea like, oh, he's afraid to say radical Islamic terror. He can't name the enemy. I think there's a price to be paid when you name the enemy. So I think they're moving as cautiously as I can, trying to prevent something from happening. And, you know, we got to worry about the Pride Parade here in Chicago next week.
Yeah.
It's a huge soft target.
You know, sure.
It's a long parade with lots and lots of people there. And so, you know, those things are very scary. And you can't protect all our soft targets. You can stop people as they go into Wrigley Field. You can check people when they're going into various arenas. But, you know, especially in the summer in the city, there's people everywhere.
Yeah, of course. Right. Yep. Eric Zorn is here from the Chicago Tribune. Stick around. We've got more ahead. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. It's Bill Leff and Andrea Darlison for Wendy Snyder on WGN. Thanks, Andrea. It's Bill Leff, along with Andrea Darlis, sitting in for Wendy Snyder for the first half. Mike Toomey will be by in the second half. Eric Zorn is here from the Chicago Tribune. Other things are going on, certainly, in the world, Eric, but one in particular that has gotten your goat, I remember you had a goat, and it's been gotten, is something that's happening with people's speech patterns. Please explain.
I can't find my goat.
Where's your goat?
Someone got it. The thing that really has been bothering me lately is this habit that some people have of turning every statement they have into a question. Have you noticed this? Either of you noticed this? Where someone...
I think I know what you're referring to. Yeah.
So it'll be this thing where they'll be talking and they'll be asking you about... But they won't actually be asking a question. They'll be making a statement.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like a tick. It's this conversational tick. Some people are bothered by other conversational things that people throw into their speech patterns, but this one is just driving me nuts. And I have a 1 minute clip I sent to Kevin, and this is like a well-educated guy. He's on the Vox podcast called The Weeds.
Yeah.
And if you just listen to this 1 minute and listen to how many, he doesn't ask a single question, but everything he says is it has that little up.
So at the end of his sentence, instead of going down as you would normally do to end a sentence, it's more of an inquisitive.
And he's a really smart guy. Someone is dumb saying this.
Right.
It's just this tick, and apparently it's unshakable. Can we listen to that?
Yeah, here it goes.
It reminds me a little bit of charter school debates, where I think you have a lot of examples of, particularly in states where it's really hard to start a charter school, of some really good ones. But then in states where you make it easy, you know, when you have like lots and lots and lots, it's like the marginal one is often not that great, because you have like a number of people who like have a good idea and a good motivation and like want to run these schools or want to work in them. And like, it's a real thing, but then there's only so many to go around. And like, by the same token, right, it's like, this could be a great opportunity for a handful of like visionary healthcare entrepreneurs. But healthcare is this super labor intensive, not highly scalable sort of business where you can't just like copy and paste the best hospital in America into every single city. And we're having some trouble like even articulating what is working well in the places that are doing really well. It's not like obvious how to repeat the success.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
You found the Barry Bonds of up-talking. That guy ended every sentence that way.
He had some good points.
I think he was good at what he does.
But I don't understand where that comes from. I mean, this guy, I don't think he's insecure at all. He's clearly one of the top pundits in the country.
Sure.
35 years old, so he's not a young guy.
Yeah.
And I don't get it. And I hear it a lot. And he's not the only one by any means. I hear this a lot from people. And I just was wondering where this comes from. And I was trying to get practitioners of it to tell me, like, why they do this? Why is everything like that?
Wait, are you brave enough to find a guy like this? Like, if you heard a guy speaking in that manner, would you be brave enough to say, hey, I'm curious, I noticed this about your speech pattern, why do you talk that way?
He did respond to me on Twitter once when I raised this issue. He was like, this is the way I talk. Get over it.
And, is that what he said?
Yeah, so maybe I'll ask him again about this.
I mean, the thing about it is,
I think that he makes really good points. I think that he's a very smart guy. And if you try to listen, I think it's impossible to listen to that and figure out what he's saying because it's so distracting.
I have a friend who's very, very intelligent, and she will end most of her statements with, you know. So she'll make a great point and say, you know, as though to say, right?
Like, right,
she,
yeah.
I think maybe sure. They need the affirmation.
Well, this is what I've heard is that it's one of the things, they go along and you're just trying to make sure that people are nodding.
Oh, yeah.
And like Bill, as I'm talking here, are you listening to me? Are we tracking?
And you're not.
I'm not.
I'm reading an Archie comic book. He's watching these people walk by outside. I thought I'd raise that as something that people should be aware of when they. And I wonder, do these people ever listen to themselves on a recording, or do they ever have anybody tell them, like, you know what, that's really annoying.
Yeah.
And it undercuts what you're saying. So I'm urging people to do that. The thing that really bothers some other people, by the way, just if we're on to conversation things, is called vocal fry. Have you heard about that?
I don't know what vocal fry is.
It's a thing where you end a sentence and your voice kind of cracks at the end.
And oh, who does that?
Apparently, a lot of young women do it, and this is a big issue. Vocal fry, yeah, and even like Ira Glass is said to do it. And
yeah,
it's this whole thing, and people learn to talk this way. I don't even notice it when people do it. So it may be some. Maybe other people don't notice.
It doesn't affect you, but other people are bothered by it.
Speaking of questions, look who's here.
Steve Bertrand is here. Cool. He's the host of the Wintrust Business Line.
But
his main gig is
as on the Mincing Rascals podcast.
Yes,
on WGN Plus every week.
We're well aware of that.
Kristen McQuarrie and John. John, what's John's last name?
John Williams.
John Williams is also on there.
Yesterday, yeah.
We have to take a break, and then we'll find out what Steve has on his show. But thank you. Good to see you again. It's been a couple of weeks.
It has been. I'll be back soon.
We'll be back next week with more Eric Zorn. All right. We'll find out what Steve has on the Wintrust Business Lunch in just a little bit. It's Bill Leff and Andrea Darlis in for Wendy on WGN.